Welcome to Talking History. My name is Carl Barbier. I'm a professor of history at Siena College and a lecturer at the University at Albany. Today, I interview Leon Carl Brown. Professor Brown is Garrett Professor Emeritus in Foreign Affairs at Princeton University. Welcome, Professor Brown.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I'd like to start with a question about your formative years, your background.
Well, I was an undergraduate student at Vanderbilt University, graduated in 1950, went for a year of study at London School of Economics and the University of Virginia. And I guess looking back, as someone who spent most of his career in academia as a historian, I was still, as we say, finding myself. I was from the beginning very interested in foreign affairs, and that got me into our diplomatic service for a brief time after the 2 separate years of graduate training. As it happened, it was really almost one of these divine providence that shapes our ends, rough-hew them how we may, having been recruited into the Foreign Service. I was given the opportunity of entering the Department of State's Arabic Language and Area Training Program, a full 18-months program, and given typical government hurry-up-and-wait, given literally overnight to make my decision. The class was starting the following day. And I, realizing I wouldn't have time to research this properly, I'd had a little bit, but very little, undergraduate training in Middle East and North African studies, I decided, why not? Let's try it. And that was way back in 1953, and now I can see that from that time onward, I've been bound to a study of this part of the world, especially the Arabic-speaking part of the world.
So it was in many ways fortuitous as a decision you had to make on the fly, I mean.
Well, exactly. And so I've often encouraged students, both graduate and undergraduate students, not to worry too much. In fact, I guess I would say I worry sometimes when I find students already so thoroughly programmed at their freshman year. Mm-hmm. I feel that they are not taking sufficient advantage of contingencies that are going to arise. I had always been interested in foreign relations and the sort of history of other cultures, but beyond that, I was not all that focused until just the opportunity presented itself to me. I had done quite a bit of work on modern Tunisian history, especially. I had translated a political treatise of a Tunisian statesman, and you could say even an Ottoman Tunisian statesman, one Khayreddin Tunisi, and written a commentary on that. I had written a book on a Tunisian modernizer, reformer, somewhat equivalent to Muhammad Ali of Egypt or to Sultan Mahmud of the Ottoman Empire, one Ahmed Bey of Tunisia, as yet another example of the Middle East being confronted by the West and responding to it. And I was really seriously considering, first, that it was time to get back to the Middle East proper, to the Mushrik, and not be just a Maghrebi specialist, and
the North Eastern African, Arab world, as opposed to
Eastern
the
Arab world, as opposed to not just the Western Arab world, and I was looking forward to a study of the period of Orabi Pasha in Egyptian history, of the sort of challenge to the existing regime in the 1870s and 1880s in Egypt that led to the British occupation. Concentrating largely on ideas of political organization, even we could say constitutional rule, and I was well embarked on that when I found myself with family, with a wife and all 3 children, in Cairo at the time of the outbreak of the Ramadan Yom Kippur October War. And the realization that this was a war initiated by 2 daring political leaders in the Arab world, Anwar Sadat and Hafez al-Assad in Syria, not in order to defeat the enemy, Israel, because they realized that was beyond their capability, but to make a sufficiently good show in order to at least provoke outside intervention of the great powers. Somehow, everything fell in line, and I thought, my goodness, here is, if not the most important single issue, certainly an issue in modern Middle Eastern history that cannot be swept under the rug. Constitutionalism, the rise of parliamentarianism, and then its abortive falling apart in Egypt, that can wait. I really need to step back and look at what historians since time out of mind have referred to as the Eastern question, as this convoluted, very difficult aspect of the East, of the European state system, slowly working to dismember the Ottoman Empire in a way that would avoid a European war, but not necessarily other problems within the Middle East itself. And that had been going on at least ever since Napoleon and 40,000 French troops had arrived in Egypt in 1798, or if not earlier, in the disastrous war for the Ottomans against the Russians, ending in 1774. And so I found myself plunged into diplomatic history, which has been the major, but not exclusive, focus of my interest ever since. So I guess it took a war to shock me into that. Let me just add one other point. One reason why I had avoided diplomatic history up to that time, even though my earlier interests were always that, was I felt very strongly, and I still feel strongly, there is a tendency on the part of us outsiders to study excessively the Middle East as an arena of outside interest, of outside politics and the like. And in doing that, we're not doing justice to the study of the history of the people. We're not paying enough attention to the Middle Easterners themselves. So I sort of tended to almost quarantine off Eastern question, diplomatic history, for that reason. I said, look, I've worked hard to become a fairly competent Arabist. I'm trying to give these people their history, to talk about them. But then, with the outbreak of the October War, I had to say, look, even studying these people without studying the extent to which they're being intertwined with them, with the outsiders, is to miss a major organizing key to understanding what's been taking place. So that's sort of got me embarked, you might say, or perhaps I could say more honestly, re-embarked on the study of diplomatic history or international relations.
Well, I'm sure you've anticipated this question. Do you think the Eastern question is still alive today?
Yes and no, because to one extent, one aspect of the Eastern question, as I sought to interpret it and reconstruct it in my study, was the phenomenon of many different pockets of political influence within the area, little states or would-be states within the Middle East, and several outside states, not just Britain, but Britain and Russia and France and even in a minor way, Germany, the many different states creating what I called in my book on this subject a kaleidoscopic nature of all kinds of jockeying for position in what is a multipolar phenomenon, not something that we Americans tend to almost take for granted. We tend to see foreign affairs in terms of one issue at a time, in terms of bipolarity. We haven't lived the way so much of Europe or certainly the Middle East have, in which there's almost always been sort of multipolarity. Now, of course, the multipolarity became largely a bipolar outside phenomenon during the years of the Cold War, but still very definitely multipolarity within. Now, for at least a certain period of time, we all talk, and understandably, of the world's only surviving superpower, of the single superpower. There is a little bit, it would seem, of something approaching unipolarity in terms of the outsider, the outside world, which I still think may well be only a transient phenomenon. It's not likely to continue indefinitely. Even so, within the Middle East itself, we still have this great multipolarity. So to some extent, and also the way in which Middle Easterners are, you might say, almost oppressively concerned with their daily political life and certainly their daily diplomatic life in terms of how this plays with how one can either frustrate the efforts of the outsider or recruit the outsider to achieve their gains within. I think that aspect of what I would call the classic Eastern question is still there. We Americans, I would trace it back to the time of Henry Kissinger, have made much of the argument that only we, as an outside power, can possibly arrange, mediate, orchestrate a settlement between Israel and the Arabs, or a settlement between now Israel, especially, and the Palestinians. That we are the only power trusted by both sides. I think that has become almost a mantra. We all tend to say that now. And in funny sort of ways, it's been pretty well accepted, at least in part, in the area. So we have reached a situation in which we're sort of hoisted by our own petard. We have made much of this, and we are seen by the parties concerned as the only power likely to be able to have a strong influence in that. Given the interest of the Bush administration in achieving certain other goals in the Middle East, it seems to me that the earlier inclination of the Bush administration to sort of take some distance from the Israeli-Palestinian confrontation, unless and until the parties seemed to be more nearly ready to back off and move toward negotiations, the terrible downward spiral of that violence on both sides really forced the hand of the Bush administration. And one can only hope and not be absolutely sure that our administration has a fairly coherent strategic plan of where we go from here. But yes, we're very much involved in it now, and it's not as if this was a choice rather freely taken without outside constraints. We almost felt obliged to do something.
Well, it would certainly illustrate what you said earlier of how the Eastern question operated, that it was a two-way street, that it was not only the attempts of European powers in the past to either interfere or to promote their interests in the region, the dismemberment of the Ottoman Empire and areas of spheres of interest and so on, but also the way in which the regional powers could involve the outside powers, in this case, the United States, and almost force the outside power to become involved in one form or another.
I think that's often a very important point, which really needs to be almost put forward as one possible way of interpreting diplomatic conduct at any time and every time. What I have in mind is quite often in areas among states, among peoples who are relatively weak vis-a-vis superpowers, great powers and the like, there's a tendency to think in terms of impotence, of we are totally at the mercy of the outsiders. The best we can hope is just to sort of dodge their crude moves that might be against our interest. We don't sometimes think through sufficiently seriously the way in which a smaller power with a different focus of immediate interest can manipulate a great power. The late Ernest Gellner, anthropologist, British anthropologist, put it well when he turned inside out the old maxim of divide and rule, of divide that you may not be ruled, and the way in which a small regional power, Middle East or elsewhere for that matter, can play off the outside powers very effectively. And I often love to cite the weary statement of one of the last Soviet ambassadors in Syria, in saying the Syrians take everything from us except advice.
Well, just returning to academic life, I was wondering whether you could share your best and your worst moments.
Now, there's going to be a rather embarrassed pause as I try to think of the best and worst, but that is surely a very useful and interesting approach, trying to confine it to more strictly academic matters, I guess, really, one of the best is that funny kind of experience when you've become so totally wrapped up in the study of a earlier time and an earlier place that you suddenly find yourself living in that time. You feel you know that time better, perhaps even than you know what's right around you. The old idea of the past being a foreign country, and then, of course, you must come back in the sort. And this sounds like a banality in a way, and this is not necessarily my best point. The best point might have been the birth of my first child or various other more substantial things, clearly. but it just comes to mind when you confronted me with that question unexpectedly, that what a wonderful feeling it was, and sort of just the thrill of being a historian, when I visited a friend and later a student, Lewis Ware, Lou Ware, who was serving as a Peace Corps volunteer in Tunis. And he had taken a lovely old house in the old part of Tunis, in the Medina of Tunis. And he told me that he had just learned that this house was the house of a Tunisian historian of the 19th century called Ahmed ibn Abi Diaf, Ben Diaf. Now, by this time, Ben Diaf had been my principal source for what is still my favorite study, the study of the Tunisia of Ahmed Bey, of mid-19th century Tunisia, of carefully trying to reconstruct what government, what society, what the people were like, and how things were, how the outside world was impinging, and how they were trying to work their way toward groping with that and becoming modern, and the whole business that I've spent so much of my time working on. And just suddenly, there was an epiphany. There I was, and Ahmed Bey, he was almost as if he was just sitting on the divan opposite me. So it was one of those great little moments that sort of made it all worthwhile. But then, of course, as I think it was David Hume said, you've got to come back from the past if you're going to be of any use to anybody and explain it all. And I've since did have to come back. But there was that moment of just sheer, unadulterated pleasure in being a part of that and being able, a feeling that you sort of course, you didn't want to fool yourself. You didn't want to be so absolutely cocky that you had it all straight, but you did have the feeling that somehow you were on the right track in understanding the very human dimension of a people at a certain period of time. And that's very satisfying.
Well, certainly, I think it's something that I think students should know, that we are in this business primarily for the pleasure of finding things out and of making that connection with past times and yet, yeah, as you say, returning to the present. One of the things that I've experienced, and I'd like your comment on it, is that very often when I say something, when I'm introduced to somebody and I say that I study the Middle East, they immediately assume that the only thing interesting about the region is the Arab-Israeli conflict or the war on terrorism. How do you deal with that in your experience when you are sort of defined by others in some ways?
Yes. Well, as in a different context, Senator Goldwater used to say, you've got to go hunting where the ducks are. In terms of getting students interested in the larger issues of the Middle East, one can make the mistake of sort of moving away from what they've learned from the daily headlines and what people are talking about in the media, or what they may have learned, you know, from their parents if they have roots in the Middle East or the like. it's not a bad idea, I think, always to go from the at least relatively well-known to the lesser-known. But I think you're absolutely right. We want to define our subject of study in a way that gives a certain sense of, you might say, gives their innings to all people involved, and not just picking and choosing of this or that issue. But again, the best way to do it is not by, as it were, wrapping their knuckles of saying, listen, all of the Israelis and all the Palestinians together are less than the population of Greater Cairo today. Let's be a little bit more comprehensive in our interest in study, but to move them step by step toward an understanding and appreciation of people in their own right. There's a lot of issues that I find myself wrestling with right now on that subject. Certainly in many history departments now, there is an effort, and a very commendable and very understandable effort, to get beyond just diplomatic history, get beyond just a history of confrontations, of what we used to call sort of disparagingly drum and bugle history or the like. I am strongly supportive of the history from the bottom up movements of cultural history and the like. But having said that, I still going to reverse myself perhaps and play the other side of the street. These diplomatic history, the histories of the grand problems of our day, if we have to pick and choose, are more important in terms of having a greater impact on people's lives than the history of this or that poet or the history of this or that peasant and the like. And we have to make that hard choice. As someone once said, reversing the English verse, you know, he said, after all, there are kings as well as cabbages. Well, there aren't many kings left, but still there are rulers. And like it or not, unfortunately, this or that ruler is just by the nature of the parceling out of political power is more likely to have an impact on your life and mine than this or that peasant or this or that poet.
And one of the things that we as educators do is to make people aware of that impact, because sometimes they're not. For example, my students are always surprised when I say that raisins from Izmir in western Turkey were on sale on the streets of Boston in 1785.
There you are.
It establishes a kind of a connection with the past that they find fascinating. So as we sort of come to the end of our program, I wanted to ask you, now that you're retired, you seem to be able to write more extensively than when you were teaching and working. And so I thought maybe the listeners would like to hear something about what you're working on now, what research projects are on the boards.
Well, I don't honestly know whether what I'm going to tell you is partially an effort to move away from the very genuine individual anguish I have in looking at the modern scene from September 11th, the horrors of that story, the downward cycle of violence in Israel and the Palestinians, a subject that I've necessarily found myself so intimately involved in studying for now almost exactly a half century. But my immediate research projects are really rather far away from all of that, and it may be escapism on my part, but I hope not. One thing is to complete a translation of the man I mentioned earlier, Ahmed Ibn Abi Diaf, who in the 1860s wrote his multi-volume history of modern Tunisia, the first volume of which was really, I think we could call it a political treatise, an effort in political theory, of Muslim political theory. And it had the advantage of being at a time when just these new Western ideas are impinging, and he's taking the measure of them. And even the terminology he uses is an interesting index of the mindset of, you might say, the classical Arabo-Islamic world, cultural world, trying to zero in on and understand a different mindset as coming in from the outside. And that is a subject that I want to finish, translate that, and with a commentary on it. And then I am considering a group of separate chapters, vignettes perhaps, of modern Middle Eastern history, including what I hope would be an effort of taking little seemingly incidental occurrences and using them as giving an insight to larger issues of what was taking place. And I'll just mention one which has just always stuck in my mind, and I'm going to have to do a lot of work to pull it together. But it concerns someone known to American historians, to Americans in general, Alexis de Tocqueville. But it's something which is not too well known to most Americans, or even in some cases, scholars who know quite a bit about de Tocqueville. In addition to his visit to our country and his writing the classic Democracy in America, he had a very important visit to recently French-captured Algeria in the 1830s. And the one scene that I'll stop with is just, to my mind, an absolutely fascinating one-liner, if I dare say, on which to build a whole historical reconstruction. When he visited the city of Algiers in the 1830s, he compared it to the city of Cincinnati just a few years earlier. And therein lies a tale that I hope to tell.
Professor Brown, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be with us.
You're very welcome.